Happy Pride from Tomboy X. We just dropped our Pride 24 collection. Queer founded, queer run, and creating size and gender inclusive underwear, swimwear, and loungewear for all bodies. So you feel comfortable in your own skin. Visit TomboyX.com to shop.
Bean Dad, The Dress, 30 to 50 Feral Hogs. If you knew what any of those were, you spend too much time online. And hey, I do too. 16th Minute of Fame is a new weekly podcast hosted by me, Jamie Loftus. And every week, we take a closer look at an internet character of the day. Who are they? What made them so notorious? How did the internet or the algorithm choose them? And what does a person do when they're suddenly confronted with more attention than the human psyche can handle? Listen to 16th Minute of Fame on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
A new season of Bridgerton is here. And with it, a new season of Bridgerton, the official podcast. I'm your host, Gabby Collins. And this season, we are bringing fans even deeper into the ton. Watch season 3 of the Shondaland series on Netflix. Then fall in love all over again by listening to Bridgerton, the official podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. Subscribe to catch a new episode every Thursday.
On the Bechdel cast, the questions asked if movies have women in them. Are all their discussions just boyfriends and husbands, or do they have individualism? The patriarchy's effing vast. Start changing it with the Bechdel cast.
Written on the pages is the answer to the never-ending podcast.
Ooh. That's a lot of them. That's some of ours.
I mean, episodes that never end, and then the podcast itself, never ending.
I'd be lying if a few different titles didn't come to name when you said the never ending podcast. There's
ooh, care to share?
No, of course not.
Okay.
But that was beautiful singing. I kind of miss, and I really enjoy when a movie starts with a whole entire song playing.
Yeah.
And you just know who everyone's name is. For some reason, that's very satisfying. I feel like I'm being like lowered into a warm bath. It's nice.
Well, this was also the era when there would be a like 3 or 4 minute credit sequence.
Yeah.
Where it's just the credits and maybe some like vague images from the world, mm-hmm. but really just people's names on the screen.
Yeah. Kind of reminded me that of anymore. Like the first Tim Burton Batman movie, similar vibe. It's just the bat signal and 4 minutes of credits and music. And you're like, yes, for some reason. Yeah. I think maybe I'm just like my brain is just slowly shrinking and I'm like, wow, less stimulation. That was awesome. I loved that. That was really good. Oh, I'm so excited for today's episode. Welcome to the Bechdel cast. My name is Jamie Loftus.
My name is Caitlin Durante, and this is our show where we examine movies through an intersectional feminist lens using the Bechdel test simply as a jumping off point to initiate a larger conversation.
Sure is.
But Jamie, what is the Bechdel test?
Well, it's a media metric created by queer cartoonist Alison Bechdel originally in her comic Dykes to Watch Out For. Started kind of as a one-off bit, but has since become a commonly accepted media metric. Sometimes it's called the Bechdel-Wallace test. A lot of versions of the test. Ooh, I'm like kind of feeling good about how this sentence is going.
You're on a roll, Jamie.
A lot of versions of how this test go. Here's the one we use. We require that there are 2 characters of a marginalized gender with names who speak to each other about something other than a man for 2 lines of impactful dialogue. What does impactful mean? Well, like it just not
open to interpretation?
Not nothing.
Maybe.
You know?
Yeah.
And today, we got a bit of a head scratcher today. But we have an incredible movie, an incredible returning guest, and I'm very excited to get started.
Yes. We are covering The Never-Ending Story with our guest, who is a writer and performer. You know her from Rutherford Falls and more famously, our episode on the Vavitch. It's Janish Meeting. Hello and welcome back.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. I love this podcast and I am so delighted and honored to be a guest again.
Oh my goodness. We're so honored to have you back.
Especially for one of my childhood hits.
Yeah.
Quite honestly.
I'm so excited to hear. Yeah. What's your like history and experience with this movie?
Deep. It's deep history. I was born in 81. Mm-hmm. So I grew up in the 80s with, you know, I think I might start a podcast about this because I am so fascinated. I'm still fascinated by like how macabre and dark and like sci-fi fantasy-ish the 80s were in terms of cinema. Like, mm-hmm. especially for kids, like for children's content.
Yeah.
Trusting that kids can deal with serious content and grandiose content, like
high concept stuff.
High concept, yeah. Like, and like the practical effects of the 80s. Like, mm-hmm. I mean, so like I was born and raised in that era of just like throwing all kinds of insane shit at kids. Mm-hmm. And this was one of my favorites. It was sort of like always in the library along with Willow and The Last Unicorn and, mm-hmm. you know, Legend and other weird, freaky things from the era.
I was getting pretty strong Labyrinth vibes as
sure.
well as
yes.
Princess Bride.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Upon rewatching this.
God, that is a lot of weird 80s kids movies. I feel cheated.
Oh, as a child of the 90s, you mean?
Yeah, I just got a bunch of really loud cartoons. Not that I, but I do love a really loud cartoon.
Sure.
I do feel like the 90s sort of switched in terms of like children's media. Mm-hmm. I feel like it made a hard turn into like YA social drama. Like, mm-hmm. I don't know. It wasn't as like fantastical as the 80s were. And
definitely.
And I'm so interested, this is why I need to do a podcast about this, because I'm so interested
do.
In why it was this way. And it has to have something to do with, you know, Reagan era politics, mm-hmm. and, you know, the space wars and, you know, all of that.
Right.
What is it called? No, Cold War.
The Cold War. Same thing.
But also, I feel like there was probably some space wars happening.
Yeah, there's like Sputnik.
There was certainly Star Wars happening.
Space race.
Yes.
Space war.
Space race. Mm-hmm. Space wars.
Yeah.
I kind of am wondering. I'm like, I wonder when that's going to come back around, too. Because that does seem like the sort of thing that will come back around. If it hasn't already, and I just don't know any children.
Right. Same. So Jana, this is one of the movies that was just like in your rotation as a child.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. Watched it once a month, probably.
Ooh.
Whoa.
Nice. Jamie, what about you? What's your history?
I had nothing. I knew the song. Mm. I knew the kind of the basics of like, it was like a fantastical 80s kids movie, but I didn't grow up with this one. I don't know why, like, I lived in a sci-fi avoidant house. I resent that. And have had to like sort of do the sci-fi work on my own as an adult. But yeah, I just never came into contact with this one. And, you know, normally it takes a couple hours to prepare for a Bechdelcast episode, but it took up like an entire day because I watched it two times and then I wanted to know about the writer. And the writer had this like kind of really beautiful and inspiring marriage that was making me cry. And I just like really went to another, I went to
did
my
Did you go to Fantasia maybe?
Wow.
Yeah. Yeah, in a way I did, Caitlin. In a way I did.
Beautiful.
But I just had like the best time. I journaled about it. It was like a whole thing. I'm so excited to talk
Jamie.
About this movie. It really affected me.
Oh my
so,
goodness.
So I'm a new but enthusiastic convert. Caitlin, what about you?
I did see this movie as a child, but it wasn't in my rotation really. I think I saw it like probably once or twice as a kid, mm-hmm. but if I'm remembering correctly, Falcor freaked me out. I could not.
That tracks.
I do see that.
And I was reminded of this when I was rewatching it to prep for this episode. And I was once again freaked out by Falcor.
Yeah.
So
it's a little freaky.
If it's not Falcor, it's the Rockbiter. If it's not the Rockbiter, it's the Bat Guy. If it's the Oracle who shoots lasers out of her tits. Like, this movie is terrifying.
It is. I think it would have been the Bat Guy for me if I was a kid.
Yeah.
Falcor, though, it sort of like, I had a moment where I'm like, they don't make them like this anymore. And maybe that's for the best. Where, like, where Atreyu is, like, really getting in there, scratching Falcor. And Falcor's making these kind of, like, he's making
orgasmic.
He's enjoying it.
Too much.
And it just kind of goes on for a little while. And then later, when he gets, like, that, like, shot, that huge shot or whatever.
Oh,
that
my
was,
God.
Yeah.
Ooh, and there's, like, a cracking noise. I was like, ooh. Falcor is in it.
Yeah.
I don't know. But I did love Falcor. But he was a little too into the scratches. Not my business.
Agree. And I also did not enjoy that they basically made no effort to have his mouth movements match up with his dialogue.
Oh,
it's just like
I
a very
like
slow like opening and closing of his mouth. But he's like speaking in full complex sentences, and I was also like, I don't like this.
I was kind of very charmed by that. That's like, ooh, there's like a needlessly detailed piece about that somewhere, because I used to be Caitlin. I feel like I've talked about it on the show before. I feel like if like animal mouths and how they move in like practical effects or CG stuff has such, because it's like Falcor, there's no sync, and that doesn't scare me.
Okay.
In the 90s, it kind of changes, and there's like an era where it's like real looking animals that never blink, but their mouths are going like, and that really scared me. I remember telling my uncle I needed to leave a screening of Cats and Dogs.
I was
freaking me out. I was so disturbed by that overly active mouth, I felt.
Yeah.
And now you have CG mouths that are kind of like people mouths, and that's also kind of like bizarre. No one's quite gotten the whole mouth thing correct.
No one can figure it out. Or then you have the live action remake of The Lion King, where you have these like photorealistic animals who are just also kind of like flapping their mouths open and closed, and just no one,
it seems wrong.
The only talking animal in a movie that looks awesome is Paddington, so,
and even then, sorry Caitlin, not always. Like,
how
sometimes
dare,
sometimes, especially when he's wet. So I feel like I'm like being on, I'm just being honest with you, I don't like how Paddington looks when he's wet.
I choose best animal, I choose T-Rex from Jurassic Park.
Okay. Yes! Well, because T-Rex isn't speaking, and it that's how it should be.
Yeah, he's roaring, and it matches up, and it looks good.
Excuse me, don't you mean she is roaring?
Oh, yes, clever girl.
Wow.
Okay, shall
so
I
So, Caitlin,
recap?
You were afraid of Falcor.
Yes.
And that's your history with it.
That is my history.
Cool.
And I haven't seen, there are two sequels, which we all kind of learned within the past 10 minutes before recording. And I haven't seen those. And there is a novel that this movie is adapted from, which I also have not read. So there's like source material. There's a whole trilogy of movies, but I have pretty limited experience.
I would like to talk about I did a little bit of research on the novel. I'd love to talk about it with you both once we've recapped the movie, because it's really interesting.
Yeah. Can't wait to hear it.
Yeah.
Well, let's take a quick break and then we'll come back for the recap.
Happy Pride from Tomboy X, celebrating Pride and the queer community all year. Queer founded, queer run, and the makers of the original boxer briefs for women, creating sustainable size and gender inclusive underwear, swimwear, and loungewear for all bodies, so you feel comfortable in your own skin. Tomboy X just dropped their Pride 24 collection, obsessively fit tested for all day comfort in sizes 3 extra small through 6X. Visit TomboyX.com.
Bean Dad, The Dress, 30 to 50 feral hogs. If you knew what any of those were, you spend too much time online. And hey, I do too.
16th Minute of Fame is a new weekly podcast hosted by me, Jamie Loftus, where every week I take a closer look at an internet character of the day. Who were they? What made them so notorious? Why did the internet choose them? And what does a person do when they're suddenly confronted with more attention than the human psyche can handle? I'll be talking to internet historians, experts, and yes, the main characters themselves to get a fuller picture. Because I think that even outside individual experiences, a character of the day tells us something about how the internet worked at that time and how the attention economy developed into the freaky three-headed dragon it is today. Together, we probably won't be able to properly log out, but we can take a walk down scary internet memory lane and see one day a little more clearly. Listen to 16th Minute of Fame on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
A new season of Bridgerton is here. And with it, a new season of Bridgerton, the official podcast. I'm your host, Gabrielle Collins, and this season, we are bringing fans even deeper into the ton. Colin Bridgerton has returned from his travels abroad. Is betrothal written in the stars for the eligible bachelor? Meanwhile, the ton is reverberating with speculation of who holds Lady Whistledown's pen. We're discussing it all. I sit down with Nicola Coughlan, Luke Newton, Shonda Rhimes, and more to offer an exclusive peek behind the scenes of each episode of the new season. Watch season 3 of the Shondaland series on Netflix. Then, fall in love all over again by listening to Bridgerton, the official podcast, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. Subscribe to catch a new episode every Thursday.
And we are back. Okay, we meet Bastion. He's a little boy. Mm-hmm. He tells his dad about another dream he has had about his mother, who has died recently. And his dad is like, Bastion, it's time to move on. Stop daydreaming. Stop thinking about unicorns and start facing your problems. Meanwhile, Bastion is like 8 years old.
Yes.
And his dad, like, I know I resent this term, even though I've used it so heavily, but like, his dad is a girl boss. It's hard to explain.
Yeah.
Well, because he's
like, get your ass to work, Bastion.
Yes.
Do math. He's Kim Kardashian. Yeah. Well, then his dad
get up and work.
Then his dad proceeds to drink a bunch of raw eggs that he blended in the blender and then just drinks as a drink.
Now that is what scares me. The dad and the raw eggs, that has always gotten my goat. Yeah. Since I was a kid, I was like, what the hell is he making?
What is this?
Who eats that?
He's into Jordan Peterson now. Wherever that dad is, he found Jordan Peterson and is eating raw meat somewhere. That was like, I had to rewind to make sure that is what in fact happened.
It is.
There is like something so, I think, like, again, just like there's so many elements of this movie that feel like rare of like, oh, you never see anything like that. Like a parent that just like, or just an adult who's like refusing to grieve in a way that is like alarming, which is so mm-hmm. common. But you're like, oh, and this guy, it's manifesting in going to work and drinking eggs. Like, yeah. All right.
Okay.
And potential homophobia. I was getting, I like yeah. had never read into this deeply, but when I was watching yesterday, I was like, Bastion is showing some very clear signs of being like a young gay boy who is really into fantasy, and not mm-hmm. to like position him as that, but like the dad being like, come on, what about sports?
Right.
Yeah.
You're not going to gym class anymore. It's like, oh, God.
Yeah.
Why aren't you drinking eggs with your pops? Like, yeah, it did feel like he was like really pushing like a hyper masculine.
Yes.
Like, I was trying to articulate in that in my notes because I was just like, it's not that like reading books or an interest in fantasy is feminine, but that's the way the dad was framing it. So it was mm-hmm. bizarre.
Yes.
Yeah.
Well, it also seemed in my, sorry to harp on this, but to me, like when I was watching it yesterday, I was like, oh, I get it. Like the death of the mom is sort of like the death of the imagination of the household, like the death of dreams, the death of like self-acceptance, like all of these magical sort of ethereal things. Like,
yeah,
I had even forgotten that Bastion's mom had died. Mm-hmm. And that's what was going on in his life.
Right.
It's so quickly skimmed over in this movie that, like,
it is glossed over.
But then it comes back hard.
Yeah.
Right. Because he's like, my mom had a name, and that's going to be the new name of the Empress.
And then it's like, his mom's name was Moonchild. That's so cool. That's awesome.
Is that what it is?
Yeah, because that's what he yells out.
That's what he yells. He yells Moonchild.
I've never known what it is all my life. I have never known what the name is. I can't understand what he's saying. And the subtitles did not say. Whoa. They just said yelling.
I had to Google it. I feel like maybe they keep it intentionally low so you can like project whatever you want onto it. Because I couldn't understand it either. And then I Googled it and it said Moonchild. And then wow. It was like earlier, he was like, my mom had the most beautiful name. I was like, damn, Bastion, you're right.
Yeah.
That's an awesome name.
Child.
Moonchild.
Yeah. I watched it twice, and the first time, I think it was on maybe HBO Max, but since then, within the past like week, it has been taken off of that platform. But whatever platform I watched it on initially, the subtitles are there, and it says Moonchild. So, Yeah. Yeah.
I think I watched it on... I rented it on Apple, mm-hmm. and it almost seemed like I was reading... another dialect's interpretation subtitles.
Yeah, some movies do that. So anyway, so point is, Bastion's mom has passed away. I think we're to understand that like his immersion in like books and fantasy is like a way that he's coping with his loss. Not totally sure, but anyway, he reads a lot of books and his dad hates it.
He's like, math and eggs and gym class.
So on his way to school, some bullies chase Bastion, and he goes into this building to hide, where he meets a man who is reading a particular book.
It's his Santa, basically, because it's like the role, and maybe it's just because we just did our like holiday segment. But I'm like, oh, mysterious older man with white hair who gives you a critical prop and then never shows up again. Mm-hmm. It's his Santa.
Yes.
Totally. Yeah.
Yeah. Exactly. And so Santa is like, kid, the books you read are safe. And yeah, sure, you can escape into the story, but you can close the book and become a little boy again. But the books I read aren't like that. And Bastion's like, what? And then the man gets up to answer the phone, and Bastion takes a closer look at this book he's reading called The Never Ending Story. Mm-hmm. Hey, that's the name of the movie. And then Bastion steals the book and runs off. He heads to school, but he's late for the math test, so he just skips it and goes to the attic and starts reading The Never Ending Story.
What a legend.
Legend.
Iconic.
I wish I would never, but it's because I'm not as brave as him.
He's so brave. Mm-hmm. Once he starts reading, we are transported into the world of Fantasia. We are in this dense forest where a couple peculiar people and creatures are gathered around a fire. And then this huge guy made of stone comes crashing in. But he's friendly and he wants to join them. And he eats rocks. And he's describing how a nothingness is spreading across the land, where like a place used to exist, but now there's nothing there. Mm-hmm. So he is going to the Ivory Tower to talk to the Empress about it. And then the other people are like, we are on that exact same mission. Let's go right fucking now. So they get on their racing snails and their bats and they set off and arrive at the Ivory Tower, mm-hmm. only to learn that the Empress has fallen ill. So now their only hope of stopping this spreading of the nothingness is a warrior named Atreyu, who lives among the plains people who hunt purple buffalo.
Arguably, you know, some heavy cultural appropriation that as a native person, I'm going to go ahead and just ignore it.
Right.
I'm gonna forgive it immediately.
Okay, good to know. Because as the characters are describing Atreyu, we cut back to Bastion and he looks at his like book bag or something, and then there's like a native person hunting a buffalo, and he's like, "It's the same."
Yeah, and it is.
Yeah.
It's interesting. It's I forgot, there's so many things about this movie that I forgot about, or just truly, it just didn't ever ring any alarms growing up. But I also like have recently been having this like really annoying discussion in my peer group, in my native peer group, about like Avatar and the way that like native indigenous people are like mythified and sort of like romanticized in media. And this is like a fucking direct example.
Yes.
For sure. Yeah. It's
but you know what? Atreyu is you know, Lakota warrior. I whatever. I don't care who what Italian country you hail from or your ancestors do. You're in as far as I'm concerned.
I kept looking for like any like the author of the book, Michael Ende, who is German, making any like clear like, and this is where I was pulling from, but he didn't seem to ever say anything specific, and so any credit, like any like reviews or in positive or negative of the book are just like, Ende appears to be pulling from what he may have once heard or possibly remembered about Indigenous Americans, and you're like,
yes,
yeah, it sounds like a vague remembering appropriative, I don't know.
Well, this is something that you might find very interesting, Jamie, and listeners, is especially the Lakota Nation. Like the Lakota Nation has so much lore, like pop, like media lore around it, especially because I think they're depicted in a lot of Westerns and what have you. But in the 70s and 80s, German people, like weird sort of hippie fringe groups, started, I don't know how the transference happened, whether it was somebody who came over and was invited to Sundance or something, but German people started putting on powwows, full regalia, singing in drum groups, like completely, and they started putting on Sundance, which is like a very like sacred ceremony that like a lot of Native people have never been invited to Sundance. Like it's just like so exclusive, and it's exclusive to like the Plains Nations. And there's this really big language, Lakota language issue happening right now with this organization that is founded by a German man who basically took stories and language from Lakota elders and like patented it and sold it back to the tribes.
Oh my God.
It's fucking insidious. And you can find videos of German people, like on YouTube, like German people doing specifically Lakota practices in their way. Of course, it's completely bastardized and they don't have any, you know, but there is this really weird link, especially in the 70s and 80s, where indigenous people have been truly like romanticized by German folks, especially.
That's so, I didn't know any of that. That's really fucked. And like, and would totally line up kind of with Michael. I mean, this, the book was published in 79. So that makes total sense. Oh my God. Okay. Well, then I find it kind of even more baffling than that he never said anything specifically. That's, oh my God, wow.
Yeah, it just like might have been in their zeitgeist a little bit, like it just was something that they kind of cared about, maybe not predominantly, but like it was there, weirdly.
Interesting, because I know that Ende was like a humanist, like he and his wife were really into the like it seems okay, so like maybe it wasn't just like a vague like it's possible that he actually had attempted to learn about indigenous culture in an insidious, fucked up way.
Maybe. Or it just might have been in his...
Or it might have just been around.
Kind of like osmosis kind of thing.
That's so bizarre. Wow.
Wild.
I want to know more about that. Interesting.
Well, so Atreyu shows up to the ivory tower and he is a child. And everyone's like, we weren't expecting a child, but I guess we have no other options. So, hey, Atreyu, go find a cure for the Empress and save our world from the nothing. So Atreyu sets off on his quest and he searches high and low and can't find any cure or solution. So he decides to seek out Morla, a wise being who lives on Shell Mountain in the Swamp of Sadness for help. And along the way, his horse Artax succumbs to the sadness of the swamp and sinks and dies in a really devastating moment.
Yeah. Saddest 80s cinematic moment short of E.T. almost dying.
Yeah.
Holy shit. And that happened so early in the movie.
Yeah.
Dude, it's like the sad, and it's like there's plenty of sad moments later, but I was not prepared for it. It's weird to be like, I loved that, but like, it's just so miraculous and wild to me that they put that in the movie at all, because it feels so clearly like an allegory for like losing someone to depression and like to suicide. And then you're just like, mm-hmm. but it's a horse. I'm crying so much. Like that was a beautiful, really dark, fucked up. Ugh.
I know.
Yeah, Jenny, you should make this podcast. I'm like, how did they do that? How is that allowed?
I know. The shit that they were showing us kids in the 80s was wild.
The horse gets too... I was like, I wrote down in my notes, like, horse gets so depressed it dies, ? Like,
yeah. Mm-hmm. And then Atreyu is like begging, like, please don't give in to the sadness. Like, keep going. You can do this. And then it doesn't work. You expect in a kid's movie, sure, there's going to be tension. You think maybe, oh no, the horse might die. But you know in the back of your mind, like, probably not, though. Probably it's going to be fine. Probably they're not going to kill an animal in a children's movie. But nope.
No.
Artax the horse dies.
In the first act or early in the second act.
Yeah. Woo! And it also, yeah. like... in talking in like opening it up to the idea of, you know, depression and suicide, and like the evil force at play here is called the Nothing, and like the fact that what they are fighting is this unstoppable wave of nothingness, mm-hmm. lack of meaning is going to overcome us and dislocate us and like destroy everything in its wake, and it is such a huge allegory, mm-hmm. you know?
For, I think, like, a lot of different things. Like, I think there's so many interpretations. My kind of, like, first and possibly the most simple one that occurred to me was, like, a coming-of-age allegory and this idea of, you know, maintaining your childlike imagination and curiosity being a good thing, even though society encourages you to lose those things as you get older and more mature.
There's like a shades of like climate change and, you know, like climate crisis and these bigger concepts that I didn't read into when I was a kid. Mm-hmm. I just accepted like the Nothing as like, ooh, yeah, the Nothing, creepy. Mm-hmm.
It's a villain. Yeah, I mean, I liked how the movie, I don't know, maybe this is like why it like knocked me on my ass. It was like, oh, the movie can kind of like meet you wherever you're at. And like, however, like it's very open to interpretation, where mm-hmm. I was reading it as like a grief story and like Fantasia as like representing the memory of his mom. And so when the Empress is calling out to him at the end, it's like, mm-hmm. if he doesn't actively engage with her memory, then it disappears, it goes away, and like you have to rebuild it. And there's so many crying.
Shit.
It's heavy. Okay, so Atreyu finds Shell Mountain in the swamp, but Morla doesn't live on Shell Mountain. Morla is Shell Mountain because he's a giant turtle. Pew, pew,
pew. Yeah, yo.
Also, we are periodically cutting back to Bastion in the attic as he's reading this book. And when Bastion learns about the giant turtle, he screams. He's like startled and scared, and he screams. And it seems like Atreyu and Morla can hear Bastion's scream. What's all that about, do you think?
And then they just kind of go back to what they were doing. Morla's like, anyways, yeah. I'm allergic to young people, which is sometimes how I feel. And
Morla is grumpy auntie. Oh my god, vibes.
Morla, I love her. A fan of Morla. I
love her. I mean, it's like
such a bitch.
She is a huge bitch, and it was clearly ruining her life to be such a huge bitch all the time. But I also felt seen.
Wait, Morla. Okay, I thought Morla was a male turtle. I guess I misinterpreted that voice.
No, Morla was definitely a gal,
a lady turtle. Okay,
gender non-specific, in my opinion.
Yeah.
Either way, bitchy energy was like, well, I certainly can't help you because even being near your youthful optimism is making me physically ill.
If Morla is a man, he's giving gay grandpa who never wanted to have kids and still doesn't.
Good for Morla, but also, you know, their loss in life, I guess.
Okay, so Atreyu is like, hey, Morla, can you help? But Morla is like, no. But I guess you could go to the Southern Oracle for help. But the Southern Oracle is 10,000 miles away. So good luck with that. But really, you should just give up. But Atreyu is not about to give up. He sets off again. And unbeknownst to him, this scary wolf creature, Gamork, is tracking him along the way. Atreyu is struggling. He's about to sink into the swamp of sadness. Gamork is about to eat him. But just then, a dragon dog thing that really upset me as a child named Falcor, the luck dragon, flies in and scoops Atreyu up. And then he wakes up a few days later, and Falcor is like, hey, what's up? I will take you to the Southern Oracle / we're already almost there. But first, Atreyu meets these small people, a married couple who hate each other named Angiwook and Urgal.
Get out of my light, wench, is kind of like how he enters the story.
Yeah. Yes. He calls his wife a wench so many times.
They hate each other. They hate each other.
Yes. Yes.
And they eat worms, I think.
Which I'm more in support of. They're, I feel like it's very, very possible that I was, I liked her so much that I was like, overly like trying to be like, this is awesome. But I liked that, like, okay, was it Angiwook and who? Urgal. So like Angiwook's whole thing is he's like, I'm a scientist, get out of my light, wench. And she is like, she makes home remedies, she's making medicine. So they are doing the same thing. They're both doing science, and she appears to know that. Her husband obviously doesn't, and she's like, that's a waste of time to explain it to him, whatever. And I was like, I wonder, I don't know. I want to believe that that was like pretty intentional of like, they're doing the same job. He just thinks his work is worthy of respect and hers isn't.
Yes.
Yeah.
That's the vibe I get. He has always, in my mind, even as a child, I was always like, why does this guy think he's such a the fucking cock of the walk? Like, she's the one who's holding the shit down.
All he did was make a telescope. Like, I mean, not that I could do that, but also like, she makes like, she heals Falcor. She gives him that big scary shot that cracked his spine open or something. She heals Atreyu. And also it seems like in the scene, Atreyu is very much more like with her of like, yeah, this guy, like Angiwook's kind of ridiculous, but hear him out. He's got this plot telescope that you need.
Right. Yeah.
That he needs to spy on people who are trying to cross the Southern Oracle, but do nothing for them. No. Just look. Just watch.
How is that science? I just was like, Angiwook.
Just watch as they get electrocuted and then gets excited about it either way.
Right.
And then he got mad because he couldn't watch someone get electrocuted. I'm like, what is your what is your life like?
Relax, Wiki Book or whatever the fuck your name is. Inky Dick.
Inky Dick.
Humperdinck. But also interesting that also in Princess Bride there's like a curmudgeon-y couple too.
Yes.
You know, played by Billy Crystal and what's that comedian's name that I love?
I know exactly who you're talking about. I'm never going to
remember. Carol Kane. Carol Kane.
Yes, Carol Kane.
Carol
yes.
Kane.
Amazing.
I was getting similar vibes there as well. Mm. Okay, so we've got Angiwook and Urgle, and Angiwook is all like, okay, Atreyu, you're going to have to pass through these gates to get to the Southern Oracle. And Atreyu is like, cool, I'm going to try it. Even though he just saw another guy get zapped by the first gate. Mm-hmm. But he's like, I got this. And he goes to the first gate, and these two like Sphinx statues with huge boobs.
Nipples.
Hot. Hot.
Yeah.
Smoking hot.
They're very sexy statues.
Yeah. And I was like, again, good for you, 80s. Those were really sexy statues you put in the kids' movie.
Oh, God. And as a kid, I was just like, oh my God, there's some boobs.
Big real ones.
They're huge.
And Atreyu manages to get through the first gate because he stays confident. Then at the second gate, the magic mirror gate, Atreyu has to face his true self, and Atreyu seems to see Bastion in the reflection, which freaks Bastion out, and he throws the book across the room, but then he's like, you know what? I'm going to keep reading. Let's see what happens.
It's already 7 p.m. I've already missed dinner. I know my dad doesn't care about me, and I'm going to spend the night in this school attic.
My dad is chugging a dozen eggs at home. Like... He's like not.
That's how he's handling the grief.
Somehow that means he's not sober. I just think it's like he doesn't drink, but he gets really fucked up on the
eggs. Fucked up on eggs. That was one of my questions. I was like, does Bastion stay there all night reading this book? And if so, does his dad not care where he is?
That's the implication.
Yeah. I feel like, and honestly, based on how Bastion's dad was coming off at the beginning, I wasn't like super bumped by that. I was like, yeah, this is the kind of parent that is not really thinking about where their kid is. And also I was like, oh, maybe that, like, it's a like late 20th century thing where your kids could just kind of be out and around and you're like, nah, they'll be back.
Oh yeah. I mean, I was a latchkey kid, kind of, so there's a heavy sort of latchkey vibes going on with Bastion.
Sure.
Yeah.
So he keeps reading the book, and Atreyu finds the Southern Oracle, which are two more statues, also with big boobs, who tell Atreyu that in order to save the Empress, she simply needs to be given a new name. But no one from Fantasia can do that. They need a human boy from Earth to give her a new name. Mm. And Bastion's like, they should ask me. My mom had an awesome name. Mm. Then Atreyu heads back to the Ivory Tower on Falkor. But on the way, the nothing blows Atreyu off Falkor's back. And he ends up in like the land of the Rockbiters, which we saw one of the Rockbiters at the beginning. He talks to one of them, and then Gamork, the scary wolf thing, is there, and he's about to eat Atreyu, and he's like, yeah, Fantasia is this human fantasy, and it's dying because humans started to lose their hope, and that's why the nothing is erasing everything.
Yeah, he states the themes of the movie. He's like, this movie was in a way about authoritarianism, if you didn't pick that up. I'm a wolf puppet. It was about fascism and its dangers. So like, I love that scene.
And Gamork is like an agent of the nothing, so Atreyu is like, well, fuck you. And he stabs Gamork in another scene that I was surprised is in a children's movie, because it's violent, it's bloody, you see like lots of blood.
Badass.
It's badass.
Kaylin, have I not been saying for years now, is like, we should be allowed to kill the evil villain if they're truly, truly, profoundly evil in the way that Gamork is? It's so satisfying.
Yeah.
It's like, we don't need a like a redemption arc for Gamork.
No, that's why I can't stand like Marvel movies and shit. I'm like, kill these motherfuckers. Sorry. It's fantasy.
That is a bad dog.
They're horrible. Yeah.
Yes. Also, I just want to say, before the Gmork slaughter, we could call it a fight. It's not a slaughter. Gamorrek attacks, and then he just happens to be holding the knife. But when he has the conversation with the Rockbiter, it's also another tear-jerky moment in the movie, I found, when the Rockbiter, this big, unstoppable beast of made of stone, is like, all of my friends are gone. Like, all of the people I love are gone. And there's nothing left of us. Like, even the rocks have disappeared. It's just like, oh God, why?
That scene really fucked me up. It's so like, it's so heavy, and it's like Atreyu is fully engaging with it, and it's just like there's no real solution to the scene. They're both just like talking to each other about like how they feel that they have failed others and how the world has failed them, and that's just like the whole scene. It's really beautiful. I love the Rock Eater. I mean, I think,
yeah, me too,
because it's
big fan.
He really did everything he could. He did his damn best, and I hated to see him down at the end. I mean, he'll be, spoiler alert, he'll be back, he'll be fine.
Riding his big stone
wheelbarrow,
power wheel thing. Like trike.
It reminded me of like it when you're like, if you're ice skating as a kid, it's like the little penguin that you hold so you don't fall over. I thought of it like that.
Exactly. I thought of it as, you know, as an 80s kid, a big wheel.
Oh, yeah.
Like a rock big wheel.
Yeah.
That is way more likely than the very obscure ice skating thing I was describing.
Well, again, that's the beauty of this movie. There are so many ways to interpret it.
Truly.
Anything is possible. Yeah.
Okay. So Atreyu has killed Gamorrek. Falcor shows back up, and Atreyu and Falcor return to the Ivory Tower, and Atreyu is like, hey, Empress, I'm so sorry, but I failed. And she's like, no, you didn't. You brought the human Earth boy with you. And he's like, what? I did? And Bastion's like, what? Are they talking about me? And the Ivory Tower is crumbling, and there's chaos. And Atreyu is like, well, where the hell is this boy? And Bastion finally realizes that he needs to do something. He needs to give the Empress a new name. So he like goes to the window. It's like lightning and storms. And he screams something that's pretty indiscernible. But
everyone's like, my mom's name. Like, I feel like that's why you can't hear it well, is you're supposed to be projecting something else onto it.
I guess. Yeah.
But canonically, he says Moonchild. So he screams it out, and then we cut to a scene with Bastion and the Empress in darkness. Fantasia has disappeared, but it can be reborn from Bastion's wishes and dreams and imagination. So he uses that to rebuild Fantasia, and so then we see all the characters that we've seen throughout the movie, Atreyu and his horse, the Rockbiter, Deep Roy and his snail, etc. And then we see Bastion riding on Falcor, and he's like, what else do you wish for? And Bastion's like, I want to go and fuck up those bullies from the beginning of the movie. So he does that.
I do think he has a realistic child impulse. He's like, I want to ride a dragon and murder everyone who's ever been mean to me. You're like, yeah.
Yep. And that's the movie. So let's take a quick break and we will come back to discuss.
Happy Pride from Tomboy X, celebrating pride and the queer community all year. Queer founded, queer run, and the makers of the original boxer briefs for women, creating sustainable size and gender-inclusive underwear, swimwear, and loungewear for all bodies so you feel comfortable in your own skin. Tomboy X just dropped their Pride 24 collection, obsessively fit-tested for all-day comfort in sizes 3 extra small through 6X. Visit TomboyX.com.
Bean Dad, The Dress, 30 to 50 feral hogs. If you knew what any of those were, you spend too much time online. And hey, I do too. 16th Minute of Fame is a new weekly podcast hosted by me, Jamie Loftus, where every week I take a closer look at an internet character of the day. Who were they? What made them so notorious? Why did the internet choose them? And what does a person do when they're suddenly confronted with more attention than the human psyche can handle?
I'll be talking to internet historians, experts, and yes, the main characters themselves to get a fuller picture. Because I think that even outside individual experiences, a character of the day tells us something about how the internet worked at that time and how the attention economy developed into the freaky three-headed dragon it is today. Together, we probably won't be able to properly log out, but we can take a walk down scary internet memory lane and see one day a little more clearly. Listen to 16th Minute of Fame on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
A new season of Bridgerton is here. And with it, a new season of Bridgerton, the official podcast. I'm your host, Gabrielle Collins, and this season, we are bringing fans even deeper into the ton. Colin Bridgerton has returned from his travels abroad. Is betrothal written in the stars for the eligible bachelor? Meanwhile, the ton is reverberating with speculation of who holds Lady Whistledown's pen. We're discussing it all. I sit down with Nicola Coughlan, Luke Newton, Shonda Rhimes, and more to offer an exclusive peek behind the scenes of each episode of the new season. Watch season 3 of the Shondaland series on Netflix. Then, fall in love all over again by listening to Bridgerton, the official podcast, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. Subscribe to catch a new episode every Thursday.
And we're back.
Before we get into the discussion, can I tell you what happens in the rest of the book?
Please.
I would love to hear.
It was really, really interesting to me. So I'm pulling heavily from an article by a writer named Helen DeCruz. The article is called What We Can Learn from the Neverending Story, Authoritarianism, Fascism, and the Power of Imagination.
Holy shit.
Wow.
It's like...
Buckle up.
Wait, this, you said the book was written in the 70s?
Came out in 79 and was a big hit in Germany and then was like translated. And so the kind of production history is that Michael Ende, the author, was originally very, very excited that they wanted to make a movie of his work. He sold the rights to the work for $50,000, which is
not enough.
Nothing. Oh, even in 1980s money, God. That's nothing.
For the amount of like times, I feel like that's just my viewing. That he's earned back is my right? solo viewing.
It's so, and I feel like we've covered, I'm trying to think of a comparable example, but it's like writers get screwed all the time in ways like that, or people with life rights or like any sort of adaptation stuff. Like you hear so many stories like that, but he was originally like, this is great. Like a German director wants to adapt my work. This is amazing. Not realizing, I think, what happens in a lot of those cases, which is that once you have sold the rights, you have very little control over what they do with it. Mm-hmm. So he's assuming his whole book is going to get adapted. He's thrilled, as is his wife. He has like, this is like very ancillary, but I enjoyed reading about it. He had this like long, it seems like kind of very beautiful relationship with a German actress named Ingeborg Hoffmann, who was a pretty successful German actress and had a huge hand in kickstarting his career. I feel like you often hear the story in the reverse, but she like used a lot. She thought he was a really talented writer and used a lot of her connections to like kind of get him his start writing. And they had a very close collaborative relationship. So even though Ende is the credited author, he would always say like, well, but like none of my work would exist if I wasn't in this relationship with this amazing person, which I thought was very nice. Mm-hmm. But anyways, he grows to really hate the fact that this movie is being made because they're like, okay, it makes the most sense for the three-act structure and for like the ethos of Hollywood in the 80s to just adapt the first half. Mm. So the movie we see is just the first half of the book, which I think kind of leaves it ending on this very optimistic note of like, you know, Bastian is going to rebuild Fantasia, which is called Fantastica in the book. Who knows why? But I just want to quote Helen DeCruz's recap of the second half of the book because it's quick and it's good. So the differences in the book as far as I can tell, it's very, very similar, except a big difference that it seems like Endy was very intentional about was that Bastion was bullied because he was fat and because he was like considered to not be traditionally intelligent. So in the book, like it's constantly referenced, especially that like Bastion has extreme issues with his own body and how people talk about him, including his father and including his bullies.
Wow.
That's like inherent to the character in a way that is not adapted in the movie. Mm-hmm. So here's the recap. Quote, in the second half of the book, Bastion creates Fantastica anew. He can do what he wishes. Oh, the other difference is that when people in Fantasia or Fantastica die or are lost to the nothing, they mm-hmm. turn into lies in the human world, which is not, it gets very like philosophical, and I'm like, I'm not smart enough to understand what he's trying to say here. Mm-hmm. But like, if you are a dragon that is consumed by the nothing, you turn into a lie that is told on Earth. That is how you, so there's like a direct consequence to the real world.
Like you become fake news.
You become a Tucker Carlson episode in the real world. It's really like, it's clear that like Endy's trying to like do something. But anyway, okay.
Yeah.
So Bastion creates Fantastica anew. He can do what he wishes, protected by the amulet Auron, which gives him amazing strength and ability. It also gives him the physical shape he believes he wants. He is no longer short or fat, but tall and athletic. Clearly, Bastion loathes himself as he truly is, and this self-loathing distorts his relationship to Fantastica. His wishes are clear wish fulfillment that slowly erode his sense of true identity. Each wish he makes, he loses part of his memory. Soon, Bastion falls under the spell of a cunning witch who aims to use him for her own purposes. He loses his friends, including Atreyu and the luck dragon Falcor, as he turns against them. Bastion's lack of memories and proper self-respect ultimately propel him to almost crown himself the Emperor of Fantastica after the childlike Empress disappeared without warning, has given him the Auron, and all of his wishes came true. He believes this is a sign that he is her successor. It totally undoes the work that happens in the first movie, and it becomes this, like, I think that the way it's written about is that this is an authoritarian kind of like cautionary tale, the way that it's written. And the moral, as I've read it, it goes on for a while, but like Bastion, by acquiring power and then like altering himself to look the way that he believes he should and like exerting power over others, ends up ruining Fantastica a second time. And it's not until he can accept himself as he truly is and love himself as he truly is, physically, emotionally, and everything else, that he's able to truly like engage with this fantastic world he's created responsibly. So the book,
it's a real Kardashian tale.
It's wild. Yeah. And I was like, that's really interesting. I'd be interested to read it, but I get why that's not in the movie. That's so depressed. Like, it's really, I don't know. Yeah. The second half of the book is wild. So Endy was really angry that they only adapted the first half. Mm-hmm. And he believes that seeing the movie killed his wife, which is another wild, his wife did see the movie and went home and went to bed and never woke up.
Whoa. Are you fucking kidding me? No
way. It is so bizarre. Yeah, she saw a screening of it and she was like, I didn't like it. And then she died.
Oh my God. First of all, how could you not like it?
I know. First and most importantly, Ingrid. But yeah.
Fascinating.
Very bizarre.
And then to supplement your research, Jamie, and I'm pulling this from Scholarly Journal Wikipedia.
Oh, hell
that
yeah.
The second half of the book was eventually used as a rough basis for the second film, Neverending Story 2, The Next Chapter, released in 1990. I have not read the book nor have seen that movie, so I can't speak.
God, such a bummer.
How, how that adaptation goes.
I have seen the second movie, okay. And I have very few memories of it. It certainly was not as impactful as the first. I remember feeling like Jonathan Brandis is trying to take the place of my Bastion, played by Barrett Oliver, and I couldn't handle it. I hated it. It's like when the older sister in Roseanne comes back as a different actor. I would just like rejected it.
Sure. Yeah.
You're like, I refuse. Yeah. No, I enjoyed reading about Barrett Oliver because he is like one of the kind of child stars that he was like in a bunch of stuff in the 80s. Yes! And then he was like, wait a second.
Oh my God.
I'm an adult.
Okay. Highly recommend that everybody watches another movie that Barrett Ooh. Oliver is like of my time. Like the movie Daryl is another one of these 80s mind fucks. It's terrifying and strange.
I've never heard of it. Wait, what is it about?
I think it was like a Disney made for TV movie, but it's about this kid that he's found and abandoned in a mountain by a family, and they sort of like take him to scientists because he has all these special abilities, and I can't remember why he has special abilities. Perhaps he's like psychic or just like he's just like a kid who is magical.
Okay.
And it's just a very strange orphan fantasy. I don't know. It's okay. Fucking weird, man.
He was also in Cocoon.
Yes.
Mm.
Yeah. This kid was prolific. I just love when a child star is extremely prolific and then they're like, I'm out of here. Because then what he does is he then becomes a really specific scholar. He's like a scholar in like 19th century photography processes now. That's
really?
What he's up to. Okay. Yeah.
That's awesome.
He's just chilling. Yeah.
Good for him.
I know.
Yeah. I didn't know any of that until like doing a little bit of prep for this episode about all of that adaptation stuff and how the author of the source material got screwed over. And then his wife died after
this movie. Did kill his wife that he loved so much. And then, but outside, I mean, honestly, I think that like the worst part of this is that he got so financially fucked over, because it sounds like they continued to use his work in future adaptations. I don't imagine he was paid again.
Mm-hmm.
But as far as like the portion of, I feel like the half of the story they adapt is like, it works. I don't know. It's beautiful.
Mm-hmm.
What studio produced it? Like, where did it?
Ooh, good question. And it was like, it was shot in, a lot of it was shot in Germany, because it's German. It's a German director.
It's
Wolfgang
a German film.
Peterson. Yeah, because he directed a movie I've only heard said out loud. Das Boot?
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Das Boot is very famous German film.
Yeah, I was like, that's the Germanest film I could think of.
Isn't it a war movie?
I think so, yeah. So I'm like, why did they give him the never-ending story? I don't really understand.
Oh,
but he did a great job.
Oh, and then he went on to, I didn't realize that he's the director of Air Force One and Outbreak. And so he like, it seems, transitioned at least partially into like American cinema. He also directed The Perfect Storm. Oh, and Troy. Okay, Poseidon.
Yeah, yeah.
There was a time
a lot of action adventure.
Yeah.
The Perfect Storm goes down in history for me as one of the worst movies I have ever seen.
It was so bad that I was laughing
aloud for the entire second half of the movie in the fucking theater. Like, oh my God. Horrible.
I'm just fascinated by people with the first name Wolfgang. That's cool.
How'd you get here?
Well, also every time I confuse Wolfgang Petersen and Wolfgang Puck all the time, so I'm like, oh yeah, Wolfgang Petersen, he has some restaurants,
he has a line of really heavy duty cookware.
Yes, and I have it.
I used to have a boss named Wolfgang Hammer, and I was like, that's not a real man. How is he standing before me when that couldn't be true? But he's real.
You know, the real award in Neverending Story, I think, goes to the production design and the costumes and the makeup. Mm-hmm. My God.
And I think that
beautiful.
The youth performances are really good in this. Like, I thought Atreyu was really amazing, and as was Bastion.
And the childlike empress. She's pretty good for the four lines she has. God.
Yeah.
Those gigantic, like, those plate-sized eyes. I was like, oh, she, I looked her up as well. She's like a professor, and then she later became like a lyrical dancer. Everyone in this movie seems to like have gone on to like live their truth. I appreciate it.
Amazing. Amazing. Yeah.
Interesting. Mm-hmm. As far as what we tend to focus on, discussion-wise, I couldn't help but notice that almost all of the characters are male or male coded. There's not that much in the way of women or girls, and if they are present in the story, they're like the Empress, who is not on screen until the very end of the movie.
She's dying
right.
And she like kind of needs to be rescued, like, yeah. That's the whole thing. Yeah,
for sure. That's that's the kind of like the thrust of the narrative. I keep saying thrust in recent episodes, and I can't explain it.
I don't know which of us started it, but one of us needs to stop.
Well, it's not gonna be me. I'm gonna keep thrusting.
Jenna, I said that out loud yesterday in our Shrek 3 episode, and I was like, why are we saying thrust right now? This is not okay.
Look,
what's not okay is that the term has been, you know, really manipulated to mean something untrue. You know,
it's true,
inappropriate.
I saw an old, I don't know what I was watching, but I saw like an old timey clip of something, of like a grown man talking to a child, where he's like, where he said, "I'm so thrilled I might bust."
No.
You used to just be able to like say kind of whatever.
Yes.
I don't think bust meant the same.
No, probably not. I hope not.
Ugh. He was like an adult man talking to Shirley Temple or something. I don't know what the fuck I was watching, but he's like, "I might bust." And you're like, "Oh my God, she's 7. Don't say bust."
Yikes.
Gross.
Anyway, so sorry for my vocabulary, but the premise of the movie is that Atreyu needs to save, you know, this young girl.
Who, for our purposes, literally a female character that needs a man to give her a name.
Yes.
Yes.
To be fair.
Yes.
Which I think does remove a lot of important context, but on its face, that is true.
Yes. So there's her, then you've got the, what is her name? Urgul, who is the his wife character of this science guy, who is given much more, I wouldn't even say he's given more narrative significance, because like all he really does is show Atreyu where the gates are to get to the Southern Oracle, but he's given way more screen time because there's just a few moments where this married couple are on screen together. They're horrible to each other. They clearly hate each other. He is throwing very gendered insults her way. Mm-hmm. He calls her a wench several times, like we mentioned. And then she's not allowed to be in the movie after that, because the movie kind of values his knowledge and skills more than hers.
Yeah, he just seems like more eager to be on screen than she does. Which he's like slamming her out of the way to be like, "And my science."
Yeah.
Which I was like kind of, I was honestly kind of like a little surprised that that happened, because the way they're introduced, he looks like the buffoon and she looks like, "Oh, well, I actually keep shit running here. I'm just not respected due to society." Also in Fantasia, apparently.
Yeah.
Right. Still a very patriarchal society there.
Yeah.
But then it like kind of changes. And then by the end, she's the one that is like, yeah, very out of frame. And then Enguwook is like stating themes of the movie in a very profound way. And I'm like, I wish that Urgul was saying this and not him, because it's like she was positioned as the person who was like smarter. And but then I was also, was I not moved when I heard, you know, Enguwook describe the like mirror of like who you truly are, like kind people find they are cruel, like courageous people find they are cowards. I just felt like he didn't earn it in the way that she did. I wish she had had those lines.
I agree.
It's a like a white man's fantasy. To me, like so much of what we know about fantasy, especially in film and in cinema, is it is from a white male patriarchal point of view. So you really rarely get you know, I feel like we see it as recent as like Game of Thrones and shit.
Yeah.
It's like, oh, you still cast the brown people as wild and like stupid and savage and, mm-hmm. you know, like the black people as slaves. Like, come on.
Yeah, it's pervasive.
Yeah. And also like, it, like you're saying, Jenna, like has not gone away in a way that is like fucking infuriating.
Yeah.
That goddamn series. I was like, oof.
I will say that the movie had more diversity than I would have expected, especially from a movie from the 80s, at least for the first like 25 minutes of the movie, because you've got Deep Roy playing the guy with the snail, whose name, according to IMDb, is Teeny Weeny. Okay.
That seems respectful.
They never refer to each other by their names on the movie.
I didn't think so. Okay.
Deep Roy is extremely iconic, though. I mean, like, legendary. I love a character actor. I salute him forever and ever.
Though his voice is dubbed over by another actor doing, I think, I couldn't remember if it was an American accent or a British accent. Mm-hmm. So Deep Roy's voice was not used in the movie, and his voice got dubbed over.
I wonder why.
Yeah, I'm not sure. And then you have the character of, I also don't know if this was, this character's name was spoken aloud, but Karen, not sure, played by Moses Gunn. He's the character who's like, we summoned Atreyu to the ivory tower,
like the spokesperson for the empress.
Yeah, exactly,
right. And I believe he does not come back, right? Like, he...
No, I don't think so.
I don't know why. Like, I don't usually do this for Bechdel class episodes, but, like, I went really deep because I just, like, hadn't seen most of these actors before. Like, I recognized Deep Roy, but that might have been it. Mm-hmm. And...
Yeah, it's giving, like, Canadian TV movie casting.
Yeah, like... Mm-hmm. And so I ended up kind of, like, doing some reading on everyone, and... The actor who plays Chiron, whatever it is.
Yeah.
He's really fucking fascinating. Like, he was like, I think kind of like a forgotten character actor who, once I looked at his filmography, I was like, oh yeah. Like, for some reason, I watched Little House on the Prairie when I was home alone when I was a kid. And he does have kind of a very memorable arc on Little House on the Prairie. He plays like a boxer, but now he's a farmer and he's hanging out with the kids. And like, his name is Moses Gunn. He won like an Obie Award. He was like a very famous theater actor. And then he pops up in this movie for not enough time, but like, he just was kind of an overlooked character actor, as many character actors are. So shout out Moses Gunn.
I think I remember him from either Little House as well, or, I don't know, The Cosby Show, I think.
He was also on The Cosby Show. Mm. Yeah. Which, I mean, I was like, I was a Nick at Night kid. It's like, we don't talk about it now, but I did watch The Cosby Show when I was a kid. Sure. Yeah, he was in everything.
Right.
He was in, you know, Hawaii 5-0, the original one. He was in Roots. He was in Little House. He was in Amityville Horror 2, The Possession. You know, he was in everything. Shaft. He was in Shaft?
Yes.
Oh, no way. A legend. So, like, shout out to Moses Gunn. And I think that he was like even more regarded on stage than he was in movies and TV. Yeah, I mean, it's like, and again, it's like, that's not a lot of diversity at all. And those characters could be removed from the story.
Right.
But I am happy that they're there. I don't like, I'm curious what you both think, because I was kind of like struggling with the many different reads you can have of this story, where there's no need for it to be so driven by young white boys and men, which it absolutely is. Mm-hmm. And so sometimes I'm like, okay, like, the whole kind of arc for Bastion is like, he needs to become confident enough in himself and like stand in his own sort of identity enough in order to be like, I am the protagonist, which is like not really a problem that white men have historically had. However, mm-hmm. I was like, with the read of like, this is a grieving child who is not being given the support that he needs from anyone in his support system and anyone who's supposed to be looking out for him, there was also a read of it where I was like, good for that kid, you know, like he, the way that the movie sort of laid out made me think a lot about like, oh, this kid really needed to like see himself somewhere as someone who could be empathetic and impactful and mm-hmm. navigate a difficult situation and survive it, which is like what Bastien needs to do. And he doesn't have that support from his dad or from his math peers. Test. I think that's his entire support system is, yeah, his bully is his dad and his math test. And yeah. So there's ways, I don't know, like I was seeing it all these different ways. It's a puzzle.
Yeah, I mean, I think it would be far more impactful if it had been a character who is largely under or unrepresented in media and literature, reading this book and seeing the, or being able to plug themselves into the story or seeing themselves in the story and then like developing that confidence. But yeah, like you said, Jamie, that has never been a problem for cishet white boys and men. So
right.
It's not as impactful as it could have been, certainly.
No.
And I feel like ultimately this is a movie about how reading is good and cool. And since we famously don't read on this podcast, I don't support the message of the movie.
Wait, I have like very, very vague memories of like maybe some of the only imagery I saw of the Neverending Story as a kid, because I didn't see the movie, was like posters at the library about how reading is awesome. Would that have happened?
Oh yeah.
Yeah.
Yes. I think that there was like in the early 80s, I remember being, I'm so interested and fascinated by what was happening in the 80s with sort of this, I think the Reagans had a lot to do with it because, you know, Barbara was, or not Barbara, Nancy Reagan was such a pro like family person. Mm-hmm. So she was really into like literacy and parenting kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. And so there was a lot of like propaganda about how to raise your kids correctly. And
right. In like a very like rigid family dynamic.
Yes.
Yeah.
In a very Republican way. Mm-hmm. And I think that we see a lot of media from this time that is about the loss of imagination and like the, like Princess Bride, for better or worse, it is also the a similar sort of setup and concept where it's a boy being told a story by his grandpa and it's about this adventure and he's in the beginning of Princess Bride, he's playing a Nintendo, he's playing an NES and like is, and his grandpa comes in and he's like, gosh, you know, you don't know what real stories are about, you know?
just like Neverending Story of Santa. He's like, my books beat me up, and you're like,
and that makes them awesome. Meanwhile, it's like, sir, have you ever played Zelda Breath of the Wild? Because that's
truly some of the best storytelling is happening via video games now.
Yeah,
so
exactly.
Jokes on you, fuckers. But I also do think that like I attach myself to that messaging because I was raised with it. Like there's a part of my brain that is like actually like ignited by that kind of messaging. It like I was indoctrinated with that messaging that like video games are bad, they teach you how to kill, they rip away your imagination, books are where the real answers are, and I believe that. It's so fucked up, but I bought into it. And
sure, yeah, of course
I still played video games, but like I like,
but it's like it's both.
It's almost as if
yes,
there is some great storytelling in video games, in movies, in television, and books, I guess. But there's also, I'm kidding. Books are cool. I know how to read, okay? but there's also like bad storytelling across all of these mediums. So it's just like, it depends on the quality of the story.
Yeah, bookheads really kind of obscure how many terrible books there are out there. Much like there's a million terrible movies and video games. Like, if there's an art form, there's a lot of bad versions of that art form.
Yes.
Yeah. If you've been to a stand-up show, you understand that. But yeah, while I do think it is like very, you know, it's like hard to even say of the era because it still very much happens all the time where it's like there is a, you know, little white boy who is put into like the role of protagonist who needs to believe he's the protagonist when there's so many people and groups who are never told they're the protagonist. And it's like reinforced over and over and over. And so on that end, you're like, well, there's actually not very much being challenged.
Right.
But I also do like have a lot of love for and like really felt, I don't know, just like watching a kid find a character that they're like, if this character can do it, then so can I. Because I remember feeling that way a ton when I was a kid. And like, I was like going back to my Lemony Snicket books where I always, all roads lead back to my Lemony Snicket books where it's like, oh yeah, like just a specific character or book or memory that you know exactly where you were at in your kid squishy brain life when you were going through it. And it was like a moment or whatever it was that like helped you push through it. And it's like, those are some of the most, I don't know, like intimate and like formative memories you can have. And it's cool that there's a movie that like tracks that exactly of like,
totally.
Yeah.
And tells Bastian at the end, like, you are important to your favorite character too. Like, that's makes me emotional. It's very nice.
Yeah,
I really love it.
Yeah,
on top of that, this is a story where, I mean, it's kind of hard to say who's the protagonist. If, well, it's like, obviously, like, it's Bastian's story.
It's like Mad Max Fury Road. Story is it?
It's Bastian's story, and then he's sort of like living vicariously through the other protagonist, which is Atreyu. Both characters are little boys who are openly expressing emotion, openly crying. They are like
struggling.
They're being vulnerable. They're struggling. Mm-hmm. They don't feel emasculated by their struggle.
They're failed by people around them who have good intentions constantly, which is always something that I feel like is underrepresented in kids' media. Is like, it's always like villain the guy who's failing you intentionally and maliciously, when I feel like it's far more common for kids to be what happens with Bastian's dad, with like someone that I'm sure that if his dad could show up for him the way that he needed to, he would want to, but he can't.
Right.
And so like Bastian's totally isolated.
Yeah. And so, and with Bastian specifically, again, he's this little boy who is a gentle, book-loving boy who gets very emotional with the art that he consumes. And then it's the relationship that he had with his mother and the grief that he's feeling toward his mother's death that, like, kind of saves the day, where he's like, oh my gosh, like, my mom's name was Moonchild and that's your name. So like, the
how
kind
did
of
Moonchild
climax...
and that man end up getting married, like,
that's why I'm saying, like, when Moonchild died, that house went to shit.
Yeah, why did Moonchild marry this guy who guzzles raw eggs every morning? Like,
he's like, I think Moonchild used to make this for me when she was alive, but no.
But how did she cook them? I don't know.
She probably scrambled them and didn't drink them raw, just a thought. But anyway, yeah, so it's like his connection, and you know, we were just talking, Jamie, about like, we're always talking about so many movies being about a relationship between father and son, and while this is that to some degree, it's about how Bastian's dad is failing him and he cannot look to his dad for any type of support, where a lot of movies about fathers and sons, the father is failing the son, but the movie is saying, like, this dad is teaching his boy how to be a man and how to repress his feelings, and isn't that awesome?
Like, celebrating the resilience of a child, because the child has to be resilient.
Right
Totally.
And this movie doesn't go in that direction. It shows, like, this father is, like, failing his son in his, like, moment of most dire need, and he has to turn to books for comfort. So yeah, I liked that. I think it's so rare to see a story where the protagonist is a boy or a man and have that character be vulnerable and crying on screen, and like things that that are perceived by society to be like emasculating, and
yeah, and have those qualities be like celebrated. And I love that, like,
exactly.
I mean, I love that he gets to stab Gamork, Atreya does.
Yes.
But that the sort of, like, I felt like the underlying message there, and I guess, like, I'm like currently kind of in like grief mode, so I was like really leaning heavy into the grief reading of this movie. Mm-hmm. But I really appreciated how it seemed like Bastian was being encouraged by the book, and Atreya was as well, to just like look it in the face and confront it. And as painful as it clearly is, it's like, that's why, I don't know, I was back and forth, because it's like, I rarely want a male protagonist, but I thought it was rare to see like a young boy encouraged to confront an extreme emotion as mm-hmm. a positive. And that's yeah. just like not common.
Yeah.
I liked it.
I think for me, as much as I want women and girls at the center of stories that I consume, mm-hmm. I also want boys who are challenging masculinity.
For like, sure.
I also, I have, it, the desire, like, knows no gender. It's sort mm-hmm. of like the same for me. Like, that journey feels the same, because perhaps it is the same that, like, mm-hmm. a woman as central is the anti-masculine, you know?
Right.
Yeah, I see what you mean.
Thrust, if you will.
Oh, okay. No. You've got another person on board. Woo!
Yeah, I totally agree. Like, I don't know. And I feel like the central, as much as it's like the childlike empress, which, what a character name. But mm-hmm. the childlike empress, she is so not a part of the story until the very end, but then she ends up being this embodiment of his mom's memory. And that was something, again, I think it was just because we covered a million holiday movies where dead mom is so part and parcel to every holiday movie that's ever come out.
Oh my God. I never thought about that, but yes.
Like, fuck. Disney Renaissance and every holiday movie ever, mommies, they're gone. They're gone, and it's vague.
Because Santa isn't a mommy. Santa is a daddy figure. So we can't Santa be having mommy figures. Daddy.
Yes.
So I think I was like, that trope has been on my mind recently anyways. And so at first I was like, oh, dead mom trope. Like, what are we going to do with this? But I think, I'm just like, it ended up kind of working for me, because so often, even though Moonchild, the dead mom, is extremely vague and we don't know a lot about her, I thought it was like really, I don't know, like I just, it really like hit with me. I feel like so often when you see a parent who's passed on, and like specifically a mother, it's always very like gentle. And I'm thinking of, I think, Casper, where like the mom mm-hmm. comes back as an angel and she tells sexy Bill Pullman and little Christina Ricci, like, mm-hmm. I just want you to be happy, and I want you to like move on. And it's still a very like maternal, like, don't worry about it. Yeah, I died at like 34. It's all good. Mm-hmm. Like, and it's very like unselfish in the way I think that mothers are often kind of typecast as like the unselfish mother.
Sure.
But it, with the childlike empress, who like, I think like symbolizes his mom, she is like begging him to remember her. And I was like, that was, I don't know, as far as dead moms go, that felt very, very active of like, no, don't just fucking never speak my name again, because all your dad can do is not have a feeling and drink eggs. Like, if you don't,
yeah,
like it feels like Coco, where you're like, if you don't talk about me, if you don't remember me, I disappear. Mm-hmm. So fucking say my name and talk about me and like rebuild this, I don't know.
Wow.
I was really into that scene.
Yeah.
And then they get to be together, and it's like he's with his mom, and she just is able to tell him, like, it's not too late. Just, like, you know, lovingly, get your shit together, kid. Mm-hmm. Like, deal with your feelings, and you can rebuild everything.
Wow.
But then when he does in the book, it turns him into a fascist. So it's
yeah,
it's complicated.
A thin fascist. So.
Yes, an athletic fascist.
Scary.
Oh my god. Well, I just like, just let the movie be the movie, author. Like, you did something weird. You did something weird.
That,
god.
Does anyone have anything else to say about the Flim?
I feel like I could go on and on about this movie, but I want to spare my stupid thoughts and let people enjoy it, because also, like, there is something about, like, breaking this movie down and how hard it is that I'm like, yeah, the intentions were so simple. we're trying to pull things from it that are, like, very much clearly in the book.
Yeah,
like, it, something was lost in translation between the book and the movie. They aren't matching up here. But was also so moving as a kid.
Yeah.
Truly swept me away every time I watch it. And even when I watched it yesterday, high as a kite, just
only way.
Shoveling popcorn into my mouth, was transported by the stupid costumes, makeup, and practical effects.
Some of which, when you're talking about Falcor, scary to me.
Falcor, was it that Falcor, did Falcor blink? I was trying to figure, I was like, what about Falcor? Maybe it was the mouth. I was focused on the eyes because they seemed really wet and they weren't blinking. And I was like, buddy.
They were,
but
kind
I was
of,
like, wait, it's not real.
I feel like they were blinking, but maybe not necessarily in unison.
Maybe it was.
And maybe that was another thing.
Maybe what it was like blinking like a Chuck E. Cheese animatronic would, where it's like blinking really loudly, where it's like, like, you know,
yeah, or there's like eyelashes that are like sort of like Snuffleupagus on Sesame Street.
Yes, you can hear it from 10 feet away and you're like, I shouldn't be able to hear someone blink like that.
Yeah. I also do want to encourage you both to look up Falcor, behind the scenes Falcor on YouTube, because I believe that there is footage of Bastion writing, or Atreyu writing Falcor against a green screen, or like a movie. Okay. It's kind of cool.
Whoa. Oh, that's amazing. I would love to know how more about, because it's like there is some very, like, you know, dated green screen effects. But for some reason, like, not to the point where I was like taken out of it to an absurd degree. I was just like, yeah, that's, I guess it's 1984. Like, who cares? I don't know. It's still, the story was good enough that you're just like, whatever. And I did kind of laugh when Bastion at the end, he's like, just had this profound, like, breakthrough in his life. And then they're like, what do you want to do next? He's like, ride a dragon and kill some kids. And you're like, yeah, cool.
Hell yeah.
Love that for him.
The and Disney Channel had to show up somewhere.
Exactly.
Well, does the movie pass the Bechdel test?
Oh, no.
I really don't think it does.
It doesn't.
It doesn't.
It doesn't.
But, you know,
we're in a pickle.
if only Falcor was a girl dog.
Well, that's what I'm saying. Like,
a girl shih tzu.
There was no reason almost every character that Atreyu encountered needed to be male or male-coded. So the only one, aside from, like, the Empress, is Morla, the turtle, who, again, I was not sure the gender of the person who voiced Morla. And
Morla, I do think, was coded as a woman.
Okay.
All the summaries I found used she pronouns. Yeah.
Got it. Okay. Maybe it was just like a very grumbly smoker's voice that
I was always sort of, I used to put her and Ursula the Sea Witch in the same sort of, like, smoking auntie character.
Sure.
A celebrated character. I love that character.
Yeah, my favorite.
I just am like, yeah, you're wrong to hate children, but I like how you do it.
you so sneeze I on their face.
It's kind of so a wash.
Are
sneeze
you
in my mouth, mommy? Like, great.
But yeah, and then so there's Morla, and then there's the wench, basically, according to her husband. And yeah, I mean, again, like, I wonder how much more impactful this movie could have been if, like, the Bastion character and the Atreyu character were, like, a little black or brown girl. rather than a little white boy, which is what so many children family movies historically have been. So anyway, no, does not pass the Bechdel test. But our nipple scale, in which we rate the movie on a scale of 0 to 5 nipples based on examining it through an intersectional feminist lens.
It's hard because it's like I've only said nice things, but for
I guess this is gonna be I'm gonna use the Bechdelcast cheat code, which is to split down the middle, give it 2.5, because while I do appreciate that it's a story about a boy who loves reading and he expresses his emotions and he like wants to grieve, or he's trying to figure out how to grieve, and his like toxic egg dad is like, no son, focus on math class. And it's
egg daddy.
Egg daddy,
he's bad.
And it's like about like young boyhood vulnerability to some degree, and I appreciate that, but there also is no reason that more of the characters couldn't be girls, women, female coded. Also no reason more characters couldn't be people of color. There also could have been more body diversity, especially since in the source material, Bastion is fat and you almost never get to see a fat kid as the hero of a movie. I think there just could have been more diversity across the board. So I don't know. It's tricky. This is a complicated one, but I'll stick with 2.5, and I will give 1 to Deep Roy. I'll give 1 to Deep Roy's racing snail. And I'll give my half nipple to Moonchild.
Moonchild. I mean, I'm honestly, like, for our metric, I'm tempted to go more like 2, which bums me out because I do think that there, I mean, if I was doing it on a personal enjoyment, how it made me feel and how much I want to watch it again, it would be like 4 to 5. Like, it really, really hit for me. But I mean, in terms of like intersectionality, there's not a lot of it.
No.
I think that like the strongest thing that this movie has going for it was what you were describing so well a couple minutes ago, Jenna, which is like encouraging young boys to confront not just like traditional expectations of masculinity, but like confront their own emotions and have that be a positive way to move through your life and have that become a heroic quality. Because I think that that is like a really, really powerful thing that, and also it's like Bastion, I don't think we've like talked, but I think that Bastion, like more so than a lot of like little white boy protagonists that I've encountered throughout my life, feels very like plug-in-able of like he's, I don't know, like it's just like I found it easy to like put myself in him because you don't know that much about him until the very, very end. So he is kind of like at, I'm like, I can't think of a better term than Avatar, which is poor cultural timing. But like he is a good character to kind of plug yourself into. But I mean, in terms of like how much this movie is pushing back, I think it pushes back on masculinity, but kind of not very much else. And like you were saying, Caitlin, there was no reason this movie had to be as white as it was and as male dominated as it was. I do kind of in general think that Bastion as a boy character really did work for me. But outside of that character, it would have been really cool to see Bastion see himself in a character of another gender, or like there were all these different ways it could have gone. And I really loved the movie and I can't wait to watch it again. And I want to share it with people. So multitudes for this one. I'm going to go 2. I'm going to give 1 to Urgel, who was a woman in STEM.
True.
And you can't tell me different.
That's right.
And then I'm giving 1 to the titty statue that could kill you if you didn't believe in yourself. That's how I like to feel like I am in relationships.
I do now recall that the lasers come out of the eyes, but boy, do they seem like they come out of the tits, though, right?
Because the tits are so present.
That would have been too far. That would have been PG-13.
Totally. Oh God. I give it 1.5, I think. And I for all the reasons that you've already said. I don't even need to expound upon it. I'm taking a half a point for Atreyu, unfortunately. I have to do that. Now, do I love this movie? Yes. But on that scale, you know, and a lot of the 80s movies that I grew up with. Boy,
don't hold up.
Really, really celebrating young boys, young white boys, in a way that is unnecessary. But that was the, I guess, important thing to discuss at the time for some fucking reason. Yeah, but also helped to develop what I believe to be the active imagination that I have now. Was highly encouraged by the Neverending Story and movies of its. In its genre and of the time and of its caliber. Like, I really felt like I was raised by these movies, and they were so strange and bizarre and wild. But I love them.
Yep.
Ugh, I want this podcast, Jana.
Yes.
I know. I'm going to make it.
I want it.
I know. I'll do it. I'll do it.
And please come back anytime to our show. Ugh,
would love.
And thank you so much for being here. Where can people find you, check out your stuff, follow you online, etc.?
Well, I have, for the most part, laid off Twitter because it's just
understandable.
So hard to be there now. But I'm on Instagram still, and you can see me on Rutherford Falls. You can see me on the TV show Reservation Dogs, which is on FX on Hulu. Mm-hmm. And also you can... listen to my podcast that I'm going to be making about the macabre media content of the 80s for children.
Woohoo!
I can't wait.
Cannot wait. you can follow us on social media at Bechtelcast. You can subscribe to our Patreon, aka Matreon, where you will get 2 bonus episodes every month, plus access to the back catalog of well over 100 bonus episodes, all at patreon.com/Bechtelcast for $5 a month.
And if you can believe it, we are covering 9,000 different adaptations of Pinocchio this month due to a bad idea
high demand.
I had. Oh, yes.
High demand from
two
the
things
listeners.
Can be true at once. And you can also grab our merch if you should so choose over at tpublic.com/TheBechtelCast.
We've got some new designs that Jamie designed, such as Shrekian.
That's it.
Such as feminist icon Paddington, such as
The Flubber Mambo by
Danny Elfman.
One of the greatest compositions of our time.
Absolutely.
And with that, should we jump on our horny puppet dragon and get out of here?
Yeah, baby.
Let's go.
Bye.
Bye.
Happy Pride from Tomboy X, celebrating Pride and the queer community all year. Queer founded, queer run, and the makers of the original boxer briefs for women, creating sustainable size and gender inclusive underwear, swimwear, and loungewear for all bodies so you feel comfortable in your own skin. Tomboy X just dropped their Pride 24 collection. Obsessively fit tested for all day comfort in sizes 3 extra small through 6X. Visit TomboyX.com.
Bean Dad, The Dress, 30 to 50 Feral Hogs. If you knew what any of those were, you spend too much time online. And hey, I do too. 16th Minute of Fame is a new weekly podcast hosted by me, Jamie Loftus. And every week we take a closer look at an internet character of the day. Who are they? What made them so notorious? How did the internet or the algorithm choose them? And what does a person do when they're suddenly confronted with more attention than the human psyche can handle? Listen to 16th Minute of Fame on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
A new season of Bridgerton is here. And with it, a new season of Bridgerton, the official podcast. I'm your host, Gabby Collins. And this season, we are bringing fans even deeper into the ton. Watch season 3 of the Shondaland series on Netflix. Then fall in love all over again by listening to Bridgerton, the official podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. Subscribe to catch a new episode every Thursday.